This is the takeaway for July 9th, 2015.
It's the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening to a pretty telling echo of a living American history. It's not something you hear every day. Legislators in South Carolina last night saying goodbye to a flag, the Confederate flag.
So my question to you is the flag that's flying on top of the dome right now offensive to anybody in this room?
Lonnie Hosey, if that flag hurts your heart, it hurts my heart.
The right thing to do is what we call the healing thing.
I cannot believe that we do not have the heart in this body to do something meaningful, such as take a symbol of hate off these grounds on Friday.
There's something so authentic and honest about these voices, as complicated and menacing as the flag is. These emotions and actions, decisions and epiphanies, all set in motion by the shooting in Charleston last month. We'll hear more of those voices later on this hour. It's not the only history that speaks in the difficult choices we face in America today. The Obama administration announced this week new regulations to try and do something more challenging than taking down a Confederate flag, to change historic and deliberate patterns of segregation in American neighborhoods. Here's how Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro says the federal government can lead the way to housing integration. Castro put it this way officially in a conference call with reporters.
The federal government should never plan for communities. It should plan with them. And we're eager to support local leaders in giving every person an equal chance to access quality housing near good schools, transportation, and jobs, no matter who they are, what they look like, how they worship, or where they're from.
The new rules will make federal aid conditional on monitoring of housing patterns for racial bias, publicly reporting those results, and making improvements. The Obama administration aims to undo decades of segregated housing policy. In light of the historical echoes in the Confederate flag debate, how hard is integration going to be to achieve? Richard Rothstein is a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and a fellow at the UC Berkeley School of Law. Christine Klepper is a veteran advocate fighting housing discrimination in Chicago for more than 40 years. She's executive director of the Housing Choice Partners Organization in Chicago. Rothstein says if you want to see this country's racial history, just take a drive to any urban area in America.
Most people today think that the segregation we have in our major metropolitan areas came about by accident. But in fact, the segregation of our metropolitan areas was created by explicit, racially conscious federal policy that was designed to segregate our metropolitan areas. It's not the unintended consequence of other policies. The two major policies that the federal government followed were first, the public housing program, which began in the 1930s, in which they demolished integrated urban neighborhoods. At that time, urban neighborhoods were integrated because workers had to live close enough to the factories where they worked to be able to walk to work. So they demolished integrated urban neighborhoods and built segregated public housing in their place, creating segregation in cities across the country, north, south, east, and west, where segregation had never previously existed. And then secondly, also beginning in the 1930s, the Federal Housing Administration guaranteed bank loans to mass production builders to create suburbs around every metropolitan area. And those federal guarantees were conditioned on a commitment by the developers not to sell any homes to African Americans. So places like Levittown outside New York, or your listeners are probably familiar with a song that Pete Seeger used to sing about houses on a hillside made of ticky-tacky south of San Francisco. Those were all segregated white-only developments built with federal guarantees on condition that they be white-only. So the entire country was suburbanized as a white-only suburban noose around central cities. Whites who were living in public housing at the time were lured out of the public housing into these white-only suburbs. They could buy homes with FHA and VA guarantees and pay monthly charges that were less than the rent they were paying in public housing.
Christine Klepper, how does that manifest itself, if indeed it does, in Chicago? And what has been effective in reversing that formidable federally induced trend?
Well, as Richard said, minorities, especially African Americans in Chicago as well as across the nation, have been so highly concentrated, isolated, And that's very damaging. Lots of research has come out recently about the damaging effects of living in toxic neighborhoods, highly distressed neighborhoods, especially for children. We know that cognitive learning is affected. We know even lifespans and health are affected. So we run a program where we work with voucher holders to help them move to opportunity neighborhoods. So opportunity neighborhoods have better schools, lower crime, and they're places where children can reach their full potential. For example, the families that we work with, they're highly motivated to do something better, to get out of poverty. I think the main motivating factor for families to move is safety. And then good schools. Kids are so often trapped in underperforming schools where they can't compete for jobs when they grow up. So we're hoping that this new rule is going to provide more opportunity, more choice, and the better life outcomes that we're looking for and that families are looking for.
Do you see, Richard, that the new federal rules can actually address some of what you were talking about a moment ago?
They can, but it's not going to be easy. It's going to take a lot of muscle, and it's going to be controversial. The programs that Christine was just talking about, for example, are not possible in most places in the country because many suburbs, again, with racially explicit motivation, adopted zoning rules that prohibit either multifamily housing from being built. The cities retain and the suburbs retain the right to veto projects that include moderate and low-income housing. The federal government is going to have to, in enforcing this rule, crack some eggs, and it's not going to be easy. In 1970, the Nixon administration actually tried to do this. They adopted a policy that middle-class white suburbs, in order to receive federal funding for water projects or sewers or anything that they use federal funds for, were going to have to repeal their exclusionary zoning ordinances, were going to have to accept housing that was public, and they were going to have to accept subsidized low and moderate income housing. That was so controversial that the program was canceled. And this new rule that the HUD is adopting is a revival of that policy, but it will be equally controversial, and there's going to have to be a lot of fortitude on the part of the federal government to enforce it.
Revisiting a Nixon administration policy scheme, that's pretty interesting here. Talk about echoes of history here. But, you know, it sounds to me like it's much easier to create an ordinance to keep people out. It's much more challenging of a policy question to create laws that will bring people in without planning communities, as Secretary Castro said, that we don't want to be actually planning communities like, you know, they do in Russia or China. Is there something that is actually doable here as far as welcoming people in that could have a tangible effect on segregation? Christine?
Well, actually, yes. I think we have shown that we can make these moves using the voucher program. It doesn't involve zoning or development or any of those things. It's a single individual using a subsidy, renting in the private market from a landlord. And most people don't know about if a voucher holder lives in their neighborhood or not. You know, again, we've found through studies looking at the few mobility programs that have existed that they work. We have to work more obviously on the things Richard talks about in terms of zoning and developments, but we have at least one strategy that we know works, and if we could bring it to scale, have more mobility programs around the country, I think we have at least one piece of the puzzle for beginning to impact intergenerational poverty.
Planning got us into this, and aggressive planning, in the words of Richard Rothstein, is going to get us out of it. Richard Rothstein is research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and a fellow at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. He's the author of the new report, The Making of Ferguson. And Christine Klepper is executive director of Housing Choice Partners in Chicago. Christine and Richard, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Last night, democracy in action in the South Carolina House of Representatives, lawmakers debating the removal of the Confederate flag. Here's Representative Eric Bedingfield, Republican from Greenville.
So my question to you is the flag that's flying on top of the dome right now offensive to anybody in this room? If it is, stand up. Ask me a question. Let's be real with one another in here today.
In a gesture that was originally declared long overdue, then unduly rushed by current events, as the hours passed last night, everyone sensed that this was a moment they needed to be part of. Representatives Wendell Guillard and Michael Pitts.
What do we do now? The scales have been shed from all of our eyes. The blindness that was our affliction that prevented us from seeing that which divides us has been lifted, and we now see what needs to be done. The right thing to do is what we call the healing thing. The gentle laying down of the past and a hopeful road to the future.
Polling in my district says leave that flag where it is. Strong polling. Polling that could hurt me in the next election. But let me tell you something, I ain't worried about the next election. I'm willing to remove that flag from the poll at some point if it causes a twinge in the heart of Lonnie Hosey or Bill Clyburn, my friends. Lonnie Hosey, if that flag hurts your heart, it hurts my heart. And that's a point I have reached.
For hours, they grappled with a history they never lived, feeling connections and emotions that were still very much alive.
That is part of history.
Yes.
That is a building.
Yes.
It's much like all of the statues and monuments that we have around here. And I think there is a difference between a monument, a statue, and a symbol.
Okay. I'm just trying to clarify if your righteous indignation ends with a piece of cloth on a flagpole and you're okay with a man who actually was a member of the Klan.
Representatives Gary Clary and Christopher Corley there, and we'll leave you with the words of Republican Jenny Anderson Horn from Dorchester, a descendant of Confederate President Jefferson Davis.
And if any of you vote to amend, you are ensuring that this flag will fly beyond Friday. And for the widow of Senator Pinckney and his two young daughters, that would be adding insult to injury. And I will not be a part of it.
Thoughts and feelings that will stay with us even as the Confederate flag's days in South Carolina or perhaps anywhere else in America are numbered.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
It's the problem of gun violence that has also resisted any reliable solution in some notable big cities in America. Chicago and Baltimore have experienced some of the worst violence in their recent history, despite an aggressive law enforcement response to shootings.
I'm angry. I'm frustrated. And I'm frustrated and angry that we're here again talking about another senseless murder. This has got to stop. We need some help here, folks. We have to fix this broken system.
That's a frustrated Chicago Police Department Superintendent Gary McCarthy reacting to shooting violence that took 10 lives last weekend. The folks Mr. McCarthy might have been pleading with there have gradually become convinced that only a radical shift in thinking can disrupt gun violence on the street. Something like paying people to put down their guns. This is what was actually tried in Richmond, California, one of the deadliest cities in America, as recently as 2007, when 47 people were killed in this community of just over 100,000. Operation Peacemakers Fellowships identified so-called lethal individuals and offered them cash, a year-long stipend, on condition they enter a mentoring program and stay out of trouble. Ronell Robinson got one of these fellowships, and it wasn't for his good grades in school.
I was incarcerated for a long time, and when you're incarcerated, you got a lot of time on your hands to think about the stuff that you did and how you want to change your life, or even if you want to change your life. I praise God that I was one of them people that was able to look at my situation and be able to join a good program like this.
Devone Bogan works with young men like Ronell as the Community Services Director at Richmond's Office of Neighborhood Safety. He says it creates a parallel universe where the people who might be considered to be the biggest losers in a community get to suddenly try out being leaders.
The pitch is simple. Help us reduce gun violence in this city. And in return, we'll help you change your lives around. And that includes, after 6 months of participating in the Operation Peacemaker Fellowship, an opportunity to earn up to $1,000 a month for 9 of the remaining 12 months of your fellowship. It starts with you. You have to put your gun down in an effort to get others to follow your lead.
Can you tell me a story of someone who was turned around in that way?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the New York Times references this particular young man who came into the first fellowship cohort meeting. And to have him in the room, we knew, was a coup, because he had a great deal of influence and certainly created a great deal of fear amongst folks that he ran with and amongst folks from crosstown rivals. And over an 18, 20-month period, this young man participated over time very actively and, quite frankly, has provided several sort of testimonials about his own transformation of being first initially very cautious about what we were talking about and what we were involved in and what we were putting forward, and then coming to a place where he was willing to not only put his gun down, but began to also tell us about other individuals that he felt needed to be involved in the fellowship to help him be more successful at his own personal commitments. He definitely has found himself, when asked to get into a car after a shooting to go and retaliate, where once he used to just jump in the car without thinking about it, he now thinks about it and often questions, if I do this, what will the Office of Neighborhood Safety think of me? That represents a completely different kind of accountability that this young man is negotiating in his mind. That's an exciting opportunity. And we have several stories like that. For example, where young men in our fellowship, and again, I got to say, John, these are considered to be the most lethal young men in our city. These are active firearm offenders who've avoided sustained criminal consequences. And these young men are saying to us over time, hey, look, I would like you to ensure that law enforcement has a presence on this side of town on this day at this time, because I believe there's going to be something that goes down, and with a presence, folks will stand down, and it gives us a greater time to go back to the drawing board and figure out what we're going to do. Essentially, it creates a pause.
Well, what would you say to people who are probably listening out there, some of them, who might listen to the story of the first individual and say, well, all that nuanced change in behavior is fine, but when someone like that shows up at the meeting, you wouldn't have to worry about any of that if you just threw him in jail right then and there.
Yeah, I get it. And I appreciate the spirit of that belief and feeling. In a perfect world, you know, each of the individuals that we're engaging would be in jail. They've committed a crime. They've either shot someone and quite possibly have murdered someone with a firearm. The fact of the matter is they're not. They're isolated. They're idle. They are negotiating a great deal of untreated trauma, vicarious trauma, and they're using all kinds of substances to cope with their own victimization around gunfire in their communities. We've got to do something differently. And in Richmond, we decided to do something differently. And as a result, our city is a great deal safer. I mean, the numbers speak for themselves, John. Since the office was created in 2007, we've seen a 76% reduction in firearm-related homicides and a 69% reduction in firearm activity overall. For the 5 years of the fellowships, we've seen a 54% reduction in firearm-related homicides and a 50% reduction in firearm-related activity with an injury. If you just look at the fellows over the past three cohorts since 2010, 94% of the most lethal young men are still alive today. 84% of those young men have not been injured with a firearm since becoming a fellow. And 79% of those young men are not suspected of a new firearm offense. That says a great deal about what we can do if we do something different.
Given the terrible statistics out of Chicago over the 4th of July weekend, what's the first thing you would suggest doing in Chicago to begin a trend that you've experienced in Richmond and scaling it up to that much larger city?
I would say that we've got to really begin to engage the individuals who are most likely to be shot, the individuals who are most likely to shoot, and actually see them, engage them, approach them as vital, viable opportunities for solving this problem.
Devone Bogan is Community Services Director of the Office of Neighborhood Safety in Richmond, California. Devone, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
If I had told you back in the 1980s that the New York Stock Exchange would go down for 4 hours with no explanation than an electronic glitch, you would probably have bought a bunch of flashlight batteries and run for a bomb shelter. But that's exactly what happened yesterday. In a day that saw the Wall Street Journal site also go down and thousands of United Airlines flights stuck on the ground in what was called a server snafu. It's quite possible that some techie with a high security clearance somewhere could illuminate this a bit beyond the Department of Homeland Security statement saying there was no evidence of deliberate sabotage. But today the headline is much like the belated acknowledgement that the Confederate flag needs to go. We're learning what insiders have known for a while, that the New York Stock Exchange is no longer some stone and marble foundation for all of the world's business and wealth. It's become just another website. With us is Heidi Moore, business editor at Mashable. Is that too extreme to say it's kind of just a website?
No, I think it's pretty much accurate. It's just a stock exchange now. We have 10 others, and stocks can be traded on any one of them just as easily. And so the New York Stock Exchange has lost its global dominance, especially because you've seen stocks in London, in China, in Australia, start to pick up a lot more of that global volume. We are in a global world, and the New York Stock Exchange doesn't straddle finance as it once used to.
So people shifted yesterday. I mean, the market just said, oh, the New York Stock Exchange is closed. We'll just go somewhere else. And there were at least 11 options.
Yeah, absolutely. It's built into the infrastructure of the market. You know, if you picture the market like a highway, and so there are each stock trade is a car going down the highway. And so if the highway gets blocked, those cars are easily detoured to another stock exchange, another highway. And so that works pretty efficiently because so many things are run by computers these days. And the computers move fast. Those cars move fast. But it's also becoming more and more efficient. But the other side of efficiency is the same way that if you play too many video games on your computer, it's going to crash. It's the same way with the stock market. It runs on computers too, and they're not invincible.
But this raises the issue that we've kind of mentioned before, and that is all those people running around on the financial channels, they're really like cast in some ancient high school musical. They're a part of theater. They don't really matter, any of them, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's a really apt metaphor because the New York Stock Exchange itself is theater. There are people on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange doing trades. They have these little machines with screens on them, and they used to yell. They used to call out, right, the men on the floor. And they're there mainly for the theater. They're there as a legacy of how the stock exchange used to work. They're absolutely not necessary because everything really is run by computers. But we do see kind of these grand world historical comparisons to devastation and loss when a stock market goes out for just a bit. But it's not true. It's a pretty cold, efficient system. It's as uncaring and as inhuman as you could possibly imagine. And it takes care of itself. So there's really no reason to kind of dramatize it. As a matter of fact, a lot of people in the stock market itself, traders, weren't worried. You know, they just took a long lunch. And this happens a lot, not just on the New York Stock Exchange, but on the NASDAQ, on other exchanges.
And I was talking with my daughter yesterday about the Friday ticker tape parade for the women. That is unprecedented for the women's soccer that will take place in downtown Manhattan. And she said, "What's ticker tape?"
Exactly.
Which is part of the same story.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, they don't even use ticker tape for those parades. They just shred some papers that they have around because we don't have ticker tape anymore. Yeah, you know, the whole financial system is still working through the legacy of what it used to be, you know, big banks or stock traders, things like that. And we're moving towards a future that we can't really describe right now. Stock trading is going to happen very differently 10 years from now. The entire financial system will look different. We don't know how that is. And so we're in this liminal stage where we're just sort of trying to muddle through and do the best we can. And so as we work through that legacy financial system and move towards a far more computerized, high-speed future, you're going to see these moments of tension, particularly as we saw on a day when Greece is having trouble, when the Chinese stock market is halfway shut down, when there were other outages of major companies. It adds a general sense of anxiety, but you know, we're going to have to work through that because that's what the stock market reacts to. And when it reacts to that, it gets more nervous, stocks spike, you get more what we call volatility, it goes up and down. Sometimes you get more volume, which means more people trading, and that tests the limits of our computer systems.
But no panic yesterday, and the good news is if you look globally, there are plenty of backups to the New York Stock Exchange, and that's probably a good thing. Heidi Moore, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Heidi Moore, business editor at Mashable. Am I getting sick? I mean, I'm beat. I had this weird dream the other night. Actually, it was more of a vision, like a hallucination.
Hallucinations are a symptom of psychosis.
Oh, come on. Psychosis with these muscle and joint pains?
It sounds like the flu.
Lung cancer.
Stress?
What about this feeling of extreme fatigue? What's wrong with me?
Poor circulation.
I think it's dengue fever problem.
Maybe you have hepatitis.
My hands and ankles are swollen.
It sounds like you're getting old.
I would suggest that you're suffering from being a graduate student or maybe fibromyalgia.
It's kind of reassuring to speak to people about this, sort of like asking, "Hey, mom, feel my head. Do I have a fever?"
It might be something like blood sugar, something to do with your glands.
I have no background, so I have no idea.
But maybe it would be better to turn to someone a little more expert, a little more confident. I hope this is not something like lupus.
Add the fact he's coughing blood. You've got three of the indicators of organ-threatening lupus.
It's lupus.
Lupus
is a bad diagnosis.
It's never lupus.
That's the TV Dr. Gregory House in the network drama of the same name. He's kind of a dream diagnostician. He solves the mystery every time. He's just a crusty jerk. Well, a new medical website means to combine the earnestness of those concerned folks on the street and all your well-meaning but clueless friends with the scientific confidence of Dr. House. It's called CrowdMed. At the very least, according to founder Jared Hyman, it's an alternative to just Googling your symptoms. And he says, it's a heck of a lot better than that.
The problem is that when a patient tries to self-diagnose, often their mind goes to the worst-case scenario. You know, they have a headache, and therefore they think they have brain cancer. And the doctor has to spend time explaining to that patient why, no, you don't have brain cancer. It's just a migraine, whatever the case may be. And the problem is the patient is kind of on their own. They're not medical experts. It's great that we have all these information resources out there, but we think that it requires more curation. We get over 20 medical detectives on an average case. We think a crowd of individual experts is better than a self-diagnosing online or just relying on one expert's opinion.
Well, please meet Dr. Daniel Kraft, who's faculty chair for medicine at Singularity University. Dr. Kraft, welcome.
Thanks.
Now, why would you want to get involved in something like this? Wouldn't you worry that if you're wrong, you could be held liable on some level?
Well, I think Jared and his team have made a great job of dictating that this is not pure medical advice. What I think is exciting as a clinician or anybody who's involved in healthcare is it gives you an opportunity to actually take some time with often very complex cases with long histories, with lots of data, that as an individual physician, when someone would come into the office with some of these problems, I wouldn't have time in my average, let's say, 12-minute primary care visit to handle, or even as a specialist in some cases. So I think the opportunity here, leveraging the wisdom of the crowd, not always pure medical specialists and clinicians, but even others, sometimes the empowered patients who've learned more than some clinicians about some areas, has a really interesting opportunity and way to change how we do elements of healthcare.
Jared is calling you a medical detective, but that doesn't mean you're like the guy on House, right?
You know, as clinicians, we like to be medical detectives. We're trained to do differential diagnosis. What I love about the platform is as a detective, you're not only helping, you know, sort through clues, help give potential solutions, but it's also a learning platform. You're seeing what others are thinking, developing that differential diagnosis, going back to the actual individual patient who's put out their clinical problem. And I think that's how, you know, with a collective hive mind and some of the other tools that are coming with data analytics and artificial intelligence, we're going to start to shift how we do smarter, earlier diagnostics and guide therapy.
Speaking of individual patients, Diana Cleveland, what made you turn to the hive mind here at CrowdMed?
Well, I believe that crowdsourcing was right up my alley because I have a very complex multi-system impacting syndrome named Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. It affects 1 in 5,000 people, and it can affect pretty much any system in the body, which is a nightmare for any paternalistic doctor. And what CrowdMed brings to the table is the opportunity for the patient to work collaboratively with medical detectives and doctors to eliminate these statistically unlikely diagnoses and then to nail down the most statistically important diagnostics to bring to your doctor so that you don't have to be shuffled from physician to physician only to be rejected or misunderstood en route to final diagnosis.
Now, Diana, did they solve your mystery or did you already know it before you went to them?
Well, here's the kicker. I had a clinical diagnosis of Ehlers-Danlos, but a lot of my symptoms were not on the classification or nosology for the disease. So I went to CrowdMed to say, hey, I have all these other symptoms that have nothing to do with what I see on NIH as the description of the disease. Well, as it turns out, when the crowd came back with Ehlers-Danlos, I was able to see that, yes, indeed, many people suffer from a lot of my symptoms. So I think CrowdMed is just, you know, a pioneer in starting the process of collaboration, and I hope it really, really takes off.
Diana Cleveland from Newbury, Massachusetts, talking very much like a doctor. She's a patient, though, who turned to CrowdMed. Jared Hyman, how can your service, can CrowdMed work for much more general maladies with the much more understandable and familiar symptoms, as well as the very specialized, unusual orphan diseases that Diana's talking about?
Well, we're not trying to become just a standard second opinion service. The average patient, our current average patient, has actually already been sick for 8 years. They've already seen 8 doctors. They and their payer have already incurred over $60,000 in medical expenses. And granted, those are our most motivated early adopters. But at the same time, we don't want to become something for an everyday, you know, colds and flus and ear infections. You know, we really want to focus on the patients who need us most and those who have really not been getting the answers they need through the traditional medical system.
So you don't want CrowdMed to be the first stop for these individuals?
That's correct.
Do you think insurance should pay for your service? Does it now?
It absolutely should. Currently, CrowdMed is 100% direct to patient, where patients submit cases on our site, they pay for the case on our site, but we've just started to reach out to insurance providers because we can save them, we believe, incredible sums of money by them sending us their most difficult and expensive patient cases. And we've seen, after resolving over 1,000 real-world cases on the site, that we can solve these cases for a very small fraction of the time and cost of what it would take through the traditional medical system. So we think it makes a lot of sense for insurers to partner with us.
Dr. Kraft, what do you think of the business model here? Doctors are frustrated but that they don't get enough time with patients, but they're also frustrated that the revenue streams in expressing their expertise are slimming down, are diminishing. This could be something new. What do you think?
Well, I think, as you know, in healthcare, a lot of the incentives are often perversely misaligned. I think many physicians and others in healthcare want to help folks, and we're often feeling in our current model of fee-for-service and short timelines that, particularly with complex cases, it's hard to be able to make an impact. And I think this is the beginning of a new movement of not only engaging, you know, different realms of clinicians, but the empowered, engaged patient who becomes the CEO of their own health, who can even decide to become a data donor. And I would imagine CrowdMed and similar services starting to leverage other elements, genomics, other things that can be shared in massive databases, which will shift how we do healthcare.
Well, Dr. Daniel Kraft, who's a faculty chair for medicine at Singularity University, Diana Cleveland, who's also with us, is a patient who turned to CrowdMed, and Jared Hyman is the founder of CrowdMed. To all three of you, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
That's all for today, but let's leave you with a few more consults with Dr. Internet. Is Dr. Internet your first stop in the healthcare system?
This is Robert from Orlando. It always seems that regardless of how benign the symptoms are, runny nose, stomach ache, you eventually end up into a rabbit hole chasing down the potential for you ending up with some sort of rare form of cancer. So I found that it's much less helpful than it would seem to be, and I prefer just to go to the doctor than find it online.
Hope you're okay. You can join the conversation, respond to anything you heard on today's show. Just call 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.